Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you to a very special episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. On this, the eve of the start of the 2021 edition of the Vendée Globe, single-handed around the world yacht race. There's just one more night ashore left for the 33 solo skippers who've assembled in the town of Le Sable d'Olonne on the Atlantic coast of France before tomorrow they set off on a race non-stop and unaided around the world. I can only formulate a wild guess at how these sailors are feeling on the day before they're taking on such a gigantic challenge. So fortunately, you don't have to rely on me because I'm joined on the show today by someone who knows exactly how that feels. Conrad Coleman, welcome back to the Yacht Racing Podcast.
G'day, thank you. It's nice to be here.
So, Conrad, 4 years ago, you were one of the skippers down in Le Sable d'Olonne, counting down the hours to the start. Can you give us some idea what's going through their heads right now? It must be nerve-wracking, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is, frankly, because one remember that these races are not built on the back of months of preparation. It is truly years of preparation. Everybody has been totally invested in every sense of the word, in terms of their professional career, in terms of having the backing and the support of their families. They've been running this race through their mind and all possible different scenarios for literally years of their life. They sailors that do this race do not wake up with every day without thinking about what's going to happen, how can I do it better, how can I prepare for every possible eventuality. So right now, the day before the start, it is, well, in some cases it's nerve-wracking for those that haven't been out there before, and there's going to be a little bit of doubt as to whether they've, you know, packed their favorite underpants or their lucky charms. A few are going to be absolutely chomping at the bit, the veterans that have been out there before, and that know the ropes, that are just keen to get stuck into it and show what they can do. So one of the consistent things that I'll be saying as we go this race is that this race is very diverse, but in the participants, the attitudes, the means that people are able to bring to bear. You know, we've got the champions, we've got the fully funded campaigns, we've got those that are there to measure themselves up against the Southern Ocean for the first time. But there's going to be a wide variety of how people are approaching this last night. But what's going to be consistent is that people cannot wait to get out there.
So back when you were taking on the race last time, it was a bit different, wasn't it? Because the race village, I'm guessing, would have been teeming with people. The atmosphere would have been electric. This race attracts a huge on-site audience that just want to come down onto the dock and touch the boats and see the skippers. If they meet them, then it's a major moment for them. France really embraces this race, but of course this time around France is in the lock of a pandemic lockdown, and from what I gather, the race village has been reduced to a virtual ghost town. It's just the teams and their support crews. How do you think that's going to change things for the sailors? Is it going to affect them?
Well, I think in many ways, it's a disappointment because, of course, we as sailors are there in Le Sable d'Olonne to take the start, and that's really just the beginning of our whole crazy adventure. Everything that's going to come is going to overshadow everything that happens in the village normally. However, that is a really special moment that we have this contact with the French public. Their enthusiasm for the race is what gives the sponsors the enthusiasm to get involved in the race and what really makes it happen. You know, you can be the most spectacular sailor in the world, but if you can't convince anybody to sponsor you because there's no enthusiasm for this race, then that doesn't exist. And very literally, every man and his dog coming down to see the boats at the start of the race is what creates the race. And I really enjoy having the contact with the public. However, it is exhausting. You know, we've already gone that thousand stair going weeks before the start of the race. Mentally, we're already projecting what's going on after the gun goes bang. And so as much as we enjoy talking to the media and talking to the public, it is certainly something that takes a lot of energy. And certainly for sailors who are, frankly, you know, we're not football stars, and we're not used to having our names called out by the public. We're not used to being hounded for interviews or for our signatures. And so it's sort of quite special on one hand, but also a bit of a challenge. In 2008, when I was working for Steve White as a préparateur, I remember Alan MacArthur walking down the dock, fully shrouded up in heavy jackets and hoods and beanies, trying to make herself as inconspicuous as possible so that she could walk around in the hordes of people that were there, just because she didn't want to be stopped every 3 seconds. So I think the village being locked down is a shame, but then you need to remember, over and above that, the sailors are all locked away in their own quarantine. So they are in houses that are rented a little bit away from the Sadelon. Some are doing sport and preparing for the race in this sort of very intimate, small communities. And in many ways, this race and this preparation doesn't reflect anything that we've seen before.
For sure. And as you were talking there, it just struck me that on the day when the boats leave, and I've been there a couple of times, been fortunate to be allowed down on the dock as media, that the atmosphere when the boats are leaving the dock, it's just the families saying goodbye and the shore team saying goodbye to the sailors. And it's a super emotional and actually very, very, very almost silent, spooky kind of atmosphere. And it just strikes me that most of them probably won't have their families there because of the quarantine. Certainly Alex Thompson in his press conference yesterday made comments of this, that he's left his family back in the UK and it's just him, Neil McDonald, I think, and what their video guy in a house hold up, still kind of quarantining. It's hard enough to leave your family, isn't it? Is it maybe better not to leave them on the dock or just be able to say goodbye in the house? What did you do?
4 years ago, I didn't have kids. And so my wife and I ran the campaign together, sort of very much hand in hand. And so it was essential that she was down at the pontoon to wave goodbye. But now I think the fact that I have kids, and hopefully the next time that I take an ocean racing start, then I think that we'll definitely do that at home. It's inevitably quite traumatic to wave goodbye to daddy. There's or mum in the case of the female sailors leaving as well. It's already a charged and, as you say, emotional moment. And I think that leaving the pontoon is sort of when it really becomes a true reality that you're heading off to sea, that it's almost not quite the last rites of a gladiator, but it's definitely this sensation that you're heading off to go do combat with something that's bigger than you. You know, it's a really heavy moment, that's for sure. And I don't think that that doing that with family, friends, and kids is something that is the best way of preparing yourself mentally for what's to come. And so if you can do that and sort of in quiet in a home, then I think that's the best way. Yeah,
so maybe the pandemic's done them a little bit of a favour from that point of view. Conrad, before we go any further, we should explain why it is that you are not down in Le Sable-d'Olonne, being one of those skippers preparing to go racing, and you're here talking to me. You're in Lorient, where you live. But I'm happy to have you on the podcast, but I think you'd rather be one of the skippers, and it wasn't for lack of trying, was it?
No, that's right. I'm delighted to be here with you, Justin, and for everybody listening, and to have this opportunity to share my passion, which is this race, with you. But I'm certainly not going to hide the fact that I would much prefer to be heading out to sea tomorrow. It's been a tough 4 years for me, frankly. I made it to the finish line at the last race, and even before I made it to the finish line, I was already dreaming about 2020 coming back and having another crack at it and seeing if I could do better. And it's been 4 years of work to, well, unfortunately, have me sit down. I got very, very close several times, and I have been flying over Europe and the world, going to conference meetings, giving speeches and conferences, meeting with umpteen potential sponsors, and we got very, very, very close. And sadly, it didn't come through. Even in the past 12 months, I had full confidence that we were going to get a program off the ground, even in the sort of last moment. I chartered a boat. I spent most of last winter preparing it as if I was heading off to sea, and was sort of constantly juggling between the conference room and the boatyard, and quickly spraying the dust off my face and scratching the glue off my fingers before going to the next meeting. And finally, it was COVID-19, and that sank the last conversations that we had. So again, we got achingly close, and I will have to learn what I can from watching this one, and certainly looking forward to getting back out there for the next one.
So you're not done with this race yet?
No, certainly not. Certainly not. This has been literally my life's work to participate in this race, and I count myself among the fortunate ones who actually managed to get one of these races on their CV. I know that it's kind of the pointy end of the pyramid, that there are lots of people that start out doing solo racing in minis. There are 80 people that race across the Atlantic every 2 years, and that narrows as you go up, as you go into Figaro, into Class 40, and into Imoca programs. And so I feel very fortunate to have had a great career thus far. It's a long way from over.
That's good to hear. Now, I want to just push you a little bit further on this, because this race, this time around, there is a really good mixture. I guess maybe it's like this every time, of veteran campaigners and newbies who are taking it on for the first time. But I want to kind of zero in on the people who've done it multiple times, because I can see it as an achievement, like you've done. You managed to find the funding, do the race, finish the race, all of which are major achievements. But I'm not sure I understand why you want to do it again. So people like Alex Thompson, this is his fifth attempt, he told us on the press conference yesterday. That's 20 years of campaigning for this race. Can you give us some idea about what it is that captivates people like you and just makes you want to commit so hard to it?
Well, I mean, I think we're just suckers for punishment, mate. but more than that, I think that the mentality required to drive somebody not only to imagine themselves doing this race, but to actually do, as you say, all of this. This kind of profile of somebody who is incredibly self-motivated and driven, perfectionist, and very resilient. And I think that kind of person is going to be unsatisfied until they've really itched that scratch. And that itch can be several things. It can be, I want to win the race, absolutely, or I just want to have my participation be the best expression of what my capacities are. And that's why we see people coming back time and time and time again. This race is, it's hard to participate in, and it's even harder to complete. And not for want of trying. Just think of Vincent Rioux, for example. In 2004, he won the race on his first outing. Fantastic. He felt like the French sailing community felt like that he had crowned the king. And he was young, he was punchy, very, very capable, and we thought that this was going to be his era almost. He got a new boat in 2008. He was dismasted while he was saving Jean Le Cam in Cape Horn. He built a new boat, came back and had another crack of it in 2012. He smacked a big metal measurement buoy in the middle of the South Atlantic, completely random, absolutely not his fault. Had a big hole in the boat, had to turn around, hit another object in 2016, which damaged his keel again in the South Atlantic and stopped him going forward. And so even if you have the talent and the application, the support of your partner, a great boat, it could still have a series of unfortunate incidents, like Vincent. Even Alex has had a tough run of it as well. You know, he didn't finish the race in 2004, didn't finish the race in 2008, didn't make it past day two in 2008. And then has been able to put this incredible run together where he's been third, second, and now, well, we'll see. So I think that there are so many things you need to put together to make it happen, that it's really tough to walk away from until you feel like you've been able to put all the pieces together.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I like that. It's just such a gigantic challenge. And when I talk to my friends who are non-sailing fans, they maybe are kind of aware of the race or they have some idea about it. But when you say, but it's non-stop and it's unaided, if you get any help from anywhere, you're out of the race. There's no dispensation for, oh, well, you really needed the help. Tell us about some of the challenges which you encountered during that last race, because I remember following your progress around the world and you did a great job of communicating with the fans back home. But God, you were really up against it at times, weren't you?
How long do you have?
Give us the highlights, Sonny.
The highlights or the lowlights?
The lowlights.
It was, first off, let me start off by saying that nobody has an easy Von Meegelen. That just does not exist. Everybody, no matter their level of preparation or their level of support, they're going to get a kick in out there. You need to be ready for that. I felt like I was, but I also feel like I had a particularly difficult participation, which... probably came from the fact that I had a very rushed preparation, less than 1 year from go to woe in terms of getting the boat, getting it ready, and I think that my race was complicated by that fact because we just didn't have enough time to validate all of the systems that we were putting on board the boat. Challenges raised their head relatively early on. I had a solar charge controller, the magic black box that controls the energy coming out of my cells, that got overexcited on a beautiful sunny day in the south, burst into flames. And so I had a fire on board, with an electrical fire that was then spreading through the cockpit and burned through the cable conduit for the crucial systems on board the boat. And so I had a lot of auxiliary damage from that. So I put out the fire, but then the autopilot wiped out, short-circuited. The boat crashed and wiped out. My big A3 Jenica that was up at the time blew up as a consequence. So these things can sort of snowball very, very quickly. One example of that was, it was also a tiny securing screw that fell out of my four-stay pin in the middle of the South Pacific. So I was caught in a massive storm, 60 knots sustained, gusting 65 for almost a day, down at Point Nemo, the most isolated place on this earth. And I came careering down a wave at 25 plus knots, but went bang at the bottom and the forestay fell off in the middle of 60 knots. So that caused the boat to wipe out. I almost lost the rig in the middle of nowhere, and I was able to save it and continue on. And then probably due to the shocks from an autopilot that was convinced that it was trying to, that it would be happier if the boat was upside down, so I kept on crashing the boat, plus the problems that I had in the South Pacific, I finally dismasted in the North Atlantic less than 1,000 miles before the finish. I lost the rig, lost all of the sails that I had up at that time. The plan had always been to use the mast, use the boom as a jury mast to get me home, but the boom had broken when the mast fell down. And so I spent 4 days drifting around gluing the boom back together, which is no small feat. It's 9 meters long and weighed almost good 80 kilos. So I had to line that up on the middle of a rocking boat, glue it back together, build in a tent to keep the composite warm enough to kick. Of course, it was February and cold. Cut a new mainsail out of the shreds of the last one, and then sailed the last 1,000 miles back under jury rig with no food. I wasn't bored when I was out there.
Wasn't there a moment when you and the boat parted company, Conrad?
There was. There was a time when I was very scared for my own safety, and that was, again, part of that that snowball in the South Atlantic, South Pacific. I was in the lazy bag, so the lazy jack system that collects the mainsail when it's down or when you have a reef, and I had to drop the mainsail to fix a problem. I was in the lazy bag, and the lazy jacks failed, and so what that meant is that the boom fell very quickly when I was riding it. Like a horse, and that projected me into the ocean in the middle of the night, of course. And so I'm a pretty safety conscious guy, and so even when the shit hit the fan, I was clipped down and stayed with the boat, but I was dragging the water beside it. And then I had to do some pretty heroic effort back on board and overcome the fact that my safety tether that had saved my life was then stopping me from getting on board. So I had to free climb without my harness back on board. So that was legitimately terrifying. But in many ways, I don't see that as a failure, because it was my good habits as a safe sailor that that saved me even when the inconceivable happened. So clip on, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one of my questions was going to be, were you scared for your own safety? Were you scared of losing your life? And I guess at that point, you must have thought this is a possibility here.
Very definitely, very definitely. The moment when my dragging in the water, I was in the water and I hoisted myself onto the side of the boat. I had to disconnect my safety harness while I was still outside the lifelines, and it was a very, very conscious, very clear conversation with myself that I had one shot at this, and if I get it wrong, then I'm done for. So, very definitely. I was very definitely afraid for my life in that instance.
Still, you've told me that story before, and it still gives me chills, I have to say. Now, let's move on and look at the race ahead of us now. 8 new foiling Amoca 60s. I mean, I think for me, this is the most exciting thing about it. I do get the whole thing about there are adventurers and there are those who are trying to win the race. And for me, I admire the adventurers, and I'll be watching all of them eagerly, but I'm also fascinated by these high performance racing machines that are more than leading edge. I think they're pretty much bleeding edge technology. These 8 boats have been built specifically for the Vendée Globe. And we've seen them on the water. We've seen videos of them. You've probably maybe even seen them close up. They're just incredible, aren't they? Even the step forward from the last race even is just gigantic.
Yeah, you hit on it right then, is that we talk about the race being sort of bifurcated into Daggerwood boats and foiling boats, but you really need to think that there are foilers and there are foilers. The new 8 boats from this generation are just absolutely streets ahead of even the last generation. As you said, there are 8 new ones, but more interestingly, there are 4 architects represented in those new 8 boats. You know, we've finally sort of broken the monopoly of the VPLP Verdier that have dominated since 2012-2013. So now we have, I'll just give you a bit of a rundown. We've got Charal, which was the first boat on the water, that went in just before the Route du Rhum and sort of shocked everybody with these huge red polyhedral foils. And they've now updated to version 2 foils. Those version 2 have been modified further with the addition of fences on them. And they have far and away the most miles of any of the new boats. And there's this strategic balance that everybody tries to play of waiting for as long as possible to push the button on the build so that you can do more design and more analysis and try and have the fastest boat on paper. But that is in tension with having as much testing as possible and validation and making the boat as reliable as possible. And so in many ways, within this 8-boat fleet, you've got very different strategies there. You've got Charles first in the water with the most testing. And then on the other end of that, with a 1K boat, you've got Quorum, skipped by Nissan, that went in the water this year in 2020. That has the least number of miles, but has maybe benefited from a little bit more design time, and it's certainly a very, very radical boat. Beyond those two, we've got DMG Mori, which is version 1.0 of Charles, sister ship built out of the same molds, but Gojiro, the skipper, is not a full charger. He's not trying to win the race. And so it's sort of interesting to see how two boats that are identical in many ways can be sailed in very different ways. And we'll see just how fast one of the new foils can go when it's not being pushed to its extreme. A little aside, the reason that Gojiro went for a new boat, even though he's never claimed to be a pretender for victory, comes from one of the rules that we had in the qualification for this edition of Globe. Because Gojiro did not finish the last race, he did not have a golden ticket to guarantee his entry into the next one. And the only way that you could guarantee your entry, because the race was oversubscribed, was to build a new boat. Because the protected categories were those that had finished the last race and those sailors that were coming with new boats.
Okay.
There's a strategic reason for in that. Also in the VPLP stable is Hugo Boss. Obviously, lots of people have spoken about him. And Alex with its very radical cockpit and deck layout. But beyond that, the whole boat, the whole package has been super optimized for running, not quite the sort of reaching and upwind that the other boats have also featured. Most notably, Jeremy said that he wanted a very flexible, a very in French polyvalent boat that can go upwind just as fast as it goes downwind. Alex has really pushed it a long way into the corner by having a boat that is super optimized for going downwind. If we move into the Verdier corner, we've got Linked Out and Apivia. These are two boats that are very similar because they both grew out of the Super 60 project that Guillaume Verdier was doing for the Volvo Ocean Race. I mean, the Volvo Ocean Race almost went for a one design Super 60, Imoca 60. They're not sister ships, even though they share very strong DNA. They're very, very interesting boats, but extremely different from the VPLP idea. And then, as I said, we've got the Quorum boat from 1K, as well as the Archea Paprec, skipped by Seb Simon. These boats have a little bit of some question marks on them, in the sense that Archea has been breaking its foils, almost every Tuesday, and has just installed new foils, both port and starboard, in the village at the Sabdalon. So completely untested, even though they are presumably significantly reinforced from the last pair. And then the San Manuel boat, Occitan, from Armel Tripon, the Black Beast with its scow bow, again, seems to be very, very quick in some conditions. And a big question mark on what we're going to see from Armel. So in some ways, we've got boats that have been on the water for 2 years that we know them as fans very well, and the sailors know them very well. And then there's lots of question marks as to what surprises might be hanging out in the wings. So we'll see what happens.
Now, I want to just ask you a technical question, because you are the master of explaining complex stuff simply for the rest of us. You talked about putting fences on the foils. Now, I'm guessing these are not fences that we have in fields. What are fences?
No white picket fences on these foils, that's for sure.
What's that all about?
Fences are kind of like little winglets that are placed perpendicular to the span of the foil. So if you can imagine the long, slender foil sticking out from side to side, then these are little fences or longitudinal winglets placed at various intervals in parallel with the flow of with the direction of the boat. And what this does is it reduces cross-span flow. So it means that you don't have as much turbulence over the foils, because these fences or winglets constrain the way that the water flows over the foil, basically. And it means that it's more likely to, or it's more stable in its performance, and it is less likely to stall like the wing of a plane.
That's good. I like that. While we're doing technical stuff, let's take a little step back. These foils, there's a lot of talk about foiling, and people probably know what foiling moths are, and they see the America's Cup boats that are doing dry laps of the race course down in Auckland, and now we have foiling ocean-going boats. So it's kind of subtly different, isn't it? Can you explain how the foiling works? How does it make these boats go faster?
Sure. Well, you need to think about sailing in terms of three epochs, if you will. Since the dawn of time, we have been, well, maybe not, because first we started off with in the Pacific with the Polynesians and their canoes, and these were long-distance catamaran canoes that, of course, derived their stability from having two hulls pushed as wide as possibly can. In the Western Hemisphere, we've largely been constrained to monohulls, and the way that you derive stability in a monohull is by putting as much weight as you can, as deep as you can. And so when you had all the square riggers, then they were running around with half a beach worth of rocks in the bottom of their keel. And that's how they had their stability. So in monohull sailing, the first epoch was put weight as much as you can down low, as deep as you can. So that led to us having deep keels on our racing yachts. That was brought into a more modern epoch where the objective was to get as much weight to windward as possible. And so the goal there is to put all of your crew up on the rail, for example. You know, we're in IRC racing, we're very familiar with trying to hike as much as possible, and the objective is to put the center of gravity of the boat as far to windward as possible. That's also led ocean races to develop canting keels and water ballast, all with the same objective. So trying to push down as much as you can on the windward side of the boat. The third epoch, and where we are now, is trying to, or in addition to pushing down on the windward side, is to lift leeward, all with the same idea. You're trying to create a torque or a rotational righting moment to counterbalance the effect of the sails. In addition to adding more righting moment by picking the boat up on one side and pushing down on the other, is that actually as we've seen in the very dramatic photos, it lifts the whole boat up out of the water. And that's done in a very good way, because in the Mocha class, you cannot have T rudders or any vertical lifting surface on the rudders. Instead of having an L or T foil at the front of the boat, carrying the weight of the boat, and then a trim tab on the rudder, these boats are actually tripods, because you're getting a lifting force out of the keel. When that's canted, it also rotates and creates a little bit of an angle of attack, so that the keel, even though it's got 2 tons of lead at its very extremity, is actually pushing up rather than pulling down, which is quite astonishing. So you've got positive lift coming out of the keel, positive lift coming out of the foil to leeward, and then the boat is just trimming itself longitudinally by sitting on the back few meters of the hull.
Yeah, and it's spectacular to watch, but life on board is a little more difficult, isn't it? These boats are, speeds that are generated now are dramatically increased from conventional boats and even from the foilers we saw last time. And life for the sailors can be pretty difficult, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, it is absolutely brutal. As the generations of the Imoca 60s have developed, we've seen more and more and more protection. And I can certainly attest to the fact that that is super important. I had a very exposed older boat last time, and I got smacked in the back when I was in the cockpit on the pedestal, and I was hit with such force that it knocked the wind out of me. And I was left gasping like a fish on the bottom of the cockpit floor. And so, you know, this is not gentle spray that is attacking these sailors out there. It's absolutely getting dressed up for combat every time you stick your head up. Given that absolute assault and the incredible apparent wind that is rushing over these boats now, it is basically impossible to look clearly at the sails and to make the small adjustments that we're so used to as racing sailors to make the correct trim. And so that's why you need to have as much help as you possibly can. There have been sailors that have been putting cameras on the foredeck or cameras on the mast to get a better perspective on the sails, so you can actually see the trim tabs, the telltales. NKE, the French competitor to B&G sailing, have made a wireless electronic telltale that will send back data as to whether the sail is correctly trimmed or not, and that can be connected to the autopilot. And then boats have been building Perspex bubbles so that the sailors can have a good look at this at the sails as well without getting spray in the face. But Alex Thompson has really pushed the game forward. He's put a number of cameras all around the boat, and then is hiding down below inside. And actually, I think that he's done something that's pretty cool here, because he can sit inside the boat dry without getting abused, and actually control the cameras to zoom in on his sails to check his trim, on the telltales to make sure that everything's okay. And I think that if you can extract more performance out of a boat rather than, well, let me backtrack and say, there are two ways of extracting speed out of a boat. One is to try and make the fastest boat you possibly can, which is what the architects do. And then when it comes time to sailing, the sailor has to try and extract as much as a bit of that potential speed out of it as possible. And so if you've got a super fast boat on paper that you're sailing poorly, then you're not going to go fast. And so if you can tune everything as much as you can, and then be as precise with your trimming as you possibly can, because you can actually see what's going on, then I think that the sailor and the architect and the theory and the practice is going to be wedded the best way it possibly can be.
But Conrad, I hear what you're saying about this enclosed cocoon that Alex has built around himself, but the purists, they're not going to like it, are they? They think you should be on deck feeling the spray in your face and the wind in your hair.
Yeah, but I'm going to do a little bit of a reality check here, because back in the beginning of this solo ocean race, back in 1967, when Sir Francis Chichester sailed Gypsy Moth for the first time around the world, admittedly with one stop, but he was definitely the person that showed that it was possible. He would take time out to go down below, have dinner. His wife, in a care package that she gave him before he left dock, gave him a velvet dinner jacket that he wore every day while he was down below and having dinner and his pipe. So, if you wait long enough, everything comes back into fashion. I don't at all think that Thompson is going to be smoking a pipe and wearing velvet. Maybe he should think about that. But I think that we've been sort of driven into this corner by the fact that the boats are faster, and it's a natural progression of the performance of the boats. You know, to put an anecdote on that, when I did the Barcelona World Race in 2014-15, I did it with Nando Fa, the Hungarian sailor who first did the Vendée Globe back in the 90s. And he said that he didn't particularly enjoy sailing his boat at times because it was so brutal and so wet and had spray on the deck all the time that he couldn't sit outside and drink his tea and watch the sun go down. I think it's just part of the natural evolution. And in many ways, be it the America's Cup or be it the Vendée Globe, it doesn't necessarily reflect what we saw in the yesteryears. But I think that's just a reflection of the way that humanity moves forward. And frankly, I think it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Because I've been sprayed in the face way too much to romanticize it.
And that's why you're here with me on the podcast, Conrad, because you know and I don't. And I'm predicting now that Hugo Boss, Alex's sponsor, massive clothing manufacturer, fashion brand, I'm sure now they are going to come up with a crushed velvet smoking jacket, the Alex Thompson Vendée Globe ring. It's coming soon, so let's look out for that. Listen, let's,
I look forward to seeing their special edition.
So let's get back to our fleet of sailors waiting in Le Sable d'Olonne. Let's not forget about them. This is the biggest challenge of their lives. Some of them are taking on for the first time. Some of them are taking it on for the second, third, and fourth, and even fifth time. How do you spend your day when it's the last day before the race? Is there still a checklist of stuff to be done? What was it like for you back then?
I think that there. I know because I'm good friends with lots of the skippers, and I've been talking to them and their shore crew. Most of the work has been done in the four preceding years. And Michel de Joyeux has the maxim that you should pack your before you leave your home port and not allow anything on board after that point, because it's just going to be superfluous and a reflection of last minute jitters. But then also there are other teams like mine 4 years ago that had counted on using the 3 weeks in the Sable d'Olonne right up until the last moment to make the final preparations. So there will be fresh food going on board. There will be the skipper's final bag of goodies or personal clothes or items going on board at the last moment. And because of the health crisis that we're in at the moment, all of the sailors have been in complete quarantine, away even from their boats and away even from their teams. And so they are running on Zoom as we're doing now, checking in with their team and then trying to maintain their mental health, be as relaxed as they possibly can. They're doing sport. Some of them are in quarantine with their personal coaches in addition to their family. And so there are final massages and sports sessions and stretching going on. But mentally, they're already at sea. They're already planning how they're going to be tackling those first few maneuvers and everything that's going to come.
And have you managed to have a look at the weather for the start? Are you seeing anything strange or startling coming up?
Yes, both of those things actually. It's going to be strange and startling in the sense that there is a little. The first couple of days of this race is going to be defined by the tale of two depressions. As we sit here just before the start of the race, there is a little low that is just a little bit northwest of the Bay of Biscay. That is not giving sort of classic downwind conditions. And in fact, the famous trade winds down the coast of Portugal and on into the Canaries are completely switched off at the moment by this current low. As you roll into Monday, then there's a secondary low that is forming across the Azores that is going to track it northwards, but bring with it headwinds, basically, for the fleet. So it's far from typical, and it's not going to be a super fast blast like everybody's been planning on. So very atypical, but that does give some opportunities for the older boats to perhaps hang on to the coattails of the new ones, because they will not be able to line up and do a horizon job as they would have otherwise been.
Interesting stuff. Conrad, I think you kind of identified a few of the key names at the front of the fleet or the newer boats. Is there anybody else that the listeners should be watching out for that you think are kind of notable people? I mean, I'll give you one. I think Clarice Kremer, the young French rookie, I think she is going to be very interesting to watch. She's not racing a foiling boat. She's been coached by Armel Lecléache. And I just think personality wise, I think she's going to be great on her communication and all of that. So she's one I'm keeping an eye on.
Yes, very definitely. Clarice is a breath of fresh air in many respects. And she was chosen for her chops in communication and giving value to her sponsor, the Banque Populaire, after their maxi trimaran blew itself up in the route to Rum. But she is, I know her, I've sailed against her. She is formidable. And so she's not just there to make up the numbers. She's got a very, very fast boat, the fastest of the non-foilers. And she's had a great preparation with all of the full force of Banque Populaire behind her. And you're quite right to highlight her, because she's going to be definitely one to watch, both in terms of being an entry point into the one-day globe, because she is great at communicating, but also she's going to do her best to rip the legs off the guys around her.
I'm right.
So the guys that I'm highlighting are those that are maybe newer to the one-day globe fan base. We've got Thomas Bouillon, who did it last year, who broke his boat after a freak accident down in the south last time, was lucky to make it back in one piece. And he was very, very fast during the Arctic race in July, but a brand new, very fast boat. Again, as I said, a development of Jan Verdier's Super 60. He's got a very innovative sail wardrobe that we'll talk about, no doubt, in future episodes. And then again, Nico Troussel. It's his first time in the Vendée Globe, but he's very experienced. He's won the Figaro two times. He's been a co-skipper on Amoca several times. He has never lined up against another Amoca 60 in anger. So he's really the biggest dark horse in this race, because he's got this new boat, but he's got this great team supported by Michel Desjoyeaux, Seb Joss, Nico Lundven, and Thomas Rouxel. Those people are either those that have done the Vendée Globe before, or in many ways deserve to have their own programs themselves. So he's had little time on the water, but has really created a dream team to get him ready. And then beyond the new boats, then I think we need to watch very closely Boris Herman and Sam Davies. They've both got older boats. Sam's is from two previous generations, but has been significantly upgraded. Boris is the old Chitana from 2015, but again with new foils. They've both got a wide range of experience. They both started out in the mini. They've both sailed Super Maxis, the Volvo Ocean Race, or Volvo boats. One of the key elements that I can sort of share regarding them is going to be a question of reliability. They've got older boats and with bigger foils, and that means that the hull is moving through the water in a very different way from how it was originally designed several years ago. And so the slamming zones where the boat is impacting the waves is in a different place from where it was originally designed for. And I have personally seen both of these boats in the boatyards with big holes cut out of them, because the core in between the layers of the carbon has been crushed from the brutal impacts. And I think that both of these teams have done what they can to bring their boats into the new generation and to make them as reliable as possible. But I think that there remain question marks as to whether you can put these massive turbos on an older boat and have them hang together.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, they're speaking to Ryan Braemar, who's been working with Boris, he said, in a straight line, we're as fast as anybody. But you're right, it's whether the reliability is there. They're hoping for sure that they've done enough reinforcement on both of those boats, I think, and fingers crossed that they have. Conrad, I'm going to put you on the spot now. We'll only do this once, but can you give me your predictions for the podium? It's virtually impossible, I know, but we have to do it.
It is virtually impossible, but...
You don't have to give me any particular order, but just who you think will be standing on the podium at the end of the race.
My podium, in no particular order, is Jeremy Bayou, Charlie Dana, and Alex Thompson.
Perfect.
They've got the experience, they've got the boat, they've got the team, they've had the time. I think those are the ones that have got... as many possible things going in their favor.
Perfect. Well, Conrad, all right. I think we've done enough for this opening episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast, our Vendée Globe special. I'm delighted that we're going to do this on a weekly basis. The day may change from time to time, but we're going to get together on Zoom and look back at the race. You'll give it your expert eye and I'll quiz you and see if we can get the most out of it. I'm really pleased we're doing this together. And you're going to be writing a regular kind of column and update on the Yacht Racing Life website as well to keep everybody up to date with your view on what's happening out on the race course. But for today, I think we've done... I've really enjoyed the chat today. I think we could carry on, but I think it's time to sign off. Don't forget... watch the start of the race tomorrow. It's on a lot of TV channels. If you're unsure whether you can get it locally, go on the Vendée Globe website, and there is a list of TV stations that are covering it. I believe that the website will cover it live as well, although I haven't, to be honest, seen anything on there that says that, but fingers crossed they will. I think all that leaves us to say, Conrad, is to wish the skippers the very best. Here's hoping they all get safely on their way tomorrow. And thanks, Conrad, for your efforts today. It's been your expert insight is absolutely invaluable. And you enjoy the start tomorrow. I know you'll be watching it. And I'll be watching
very closely.
I'm sure you will. And I'll speak to you on the next episode of the show, Conrad.
Sounds good. Thanks very much. And don't forget to send in your questions or comments. Tell us that we're wrong, tell us that we're right, or send in your questions. And if I don't know the answer myself, I certainly know the guy who does. So don't be afraid to interact with us.
Let's give you an email address for that. You can use info@yachtracing.life. That's info@yachtracing.life. And we'll make sure those get through to Conrad. All right.
Good. See you next time.
See you next time.